We'll go ahead and get started. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. I'm Scott Schiff, hosting the Atlas Society's Senior Fellow, Rob Trzynski, on Which Way, Western Man? We encourage questions, so as Rob is offering his take, feel free to raise your hand and we'll bring you up. Rob, it's a provocative title. I took the liberty of linking to the piece I found about it. So
this is a discourse piece, right?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you.
Sure. Which Way, Western Man?
All right. So I'm riffing here at the title, Which Way, Western Man? I'm kind of doing a riff on a longstanding meme often used by nationalist conservatives or religious traditionalists, with the idea that they'll put up, usually they'll put up some version where it's, it's on the one side is a picture of a polyamorous, a really pathetic, cringe-inducing, like totally non-glamorous, you know, polyamorous, modern, sort of woke relationship. And on the other side will be a traditional family with these, you know, smiling, happy blonde kids. There's a Twitter feed called Architectural Revival, which focuses on this idea of really pushing the idea that traditional architecture is better than modern architecture. And they'll put on one side, they'll put the absolute worst, ugliest, most bizarre and weird examples of modern architecture. Often, usually, it's actually postmodern architecture. It's not even modernism, but they call it modernist architecture. And on the other side, they'll put stuff that is basically lovingly restored, old buildings that make you want to take up permanent residence in a Jane Austen novel. And so it's sort of, they're stacking the deck, obviously, with these images of saying traditional society was so much better and modern society is so much worse. I mean, it's led to some sort of ironic uses of it. The funniest version I saw, which was posted, as far as I can tell, in all sincerity, but during the riots we had, the Black Lives Matter riots a couple of years back, the summer of 2000?
2017.
No, the Black Lives Matter was.
Oh.
I think it's 2020 or 2021. It's all blurred to me now.
When the protests were happening?
Yeah, the Black Lives Matter protests.
It was 2020, the summer.
Yeah, that was 2020. That's right. It only seems like it was longer ago. When they had those riots, somebody posted this picture of some quaint, picturesque medieval village and saying, well, you don't see any riots here. Now, if you've read your history books, you know that there were plenty of riots and disturbances and witch burnings and uprisings against the local feudal lords, etc., that happened all throughout the Middle Ages. But it's this idea of stacking the decks and saying traditional society. And now by they mean traditional, I mean they mean society that's based on tradition, that's justified by an appeal to tradition, traditional religion, you know, traditional social arrangements, traditional architecture, everything, that this is better than anything that's being done in the modern age. And typically this is done with under the heading, Which Way, Western Man? Now, the actual origin of Which Way, Western Man is somewhat uglier because it actually comes from, that's the title of a book written by a white supremacist, basically saying that you have to go, you know, his version of traditionalism is, you know, white people should rule and have dominance over the culture, and all minorities should be second class citizens or removed entirely. But it became this meme that is used not necessarily by white supremacists, but by these sort of conservative traditionalists to say that traditional society is so much better, and a society based on religious traditionalism and with government promoting religious traditionalism is so much better. And everything modern and everything new in society is terrible. Now, I applied this though to the question of, I think the war in Ukraine has been clarifying in that respect, because for a lot of these people, Vladimir Putin was a sort of a hero. He was a representative of somebody, a political leader who would stand up and fight for traditionalism and fight for this traditional society against all the corruption of all these modern changes. and the modern sensibility. And specifically the idea that he billed himself as using the power of the state to promote the power of the church. He has this sort of Attila and the Witch Doctor symbiosis with Patriarch Kirill, he's the patriarch of the Eastern Orthodox Church that's based in, he's the patriarch of Moscow, the head of the Eastern Orthodox Church, the Russian Orthodox Church that's based in Moscow. And he gave, the beginning of the invasion of Ukraine, gave this huge speech about how important it was that we had to fight this. And the reason was we were fighting against the West, and the imperialism of the West, the oppression of the West, was summed up in one demand that they always make, which is you have to have a gay parade. He put it as a gay parade, meaning a gay pride parade. And so, you know, allowing homosexuals to be out and open and not not sort of regarded as second-class citizens, this is the oppression that the West forces on other people. It's clear that takes up a lot of headspace in Kirill's mind. Sort of the way that, and it's sort of the way that Drag Queen Story Hour takes up a lot of headspace in the minds of a lot of the nationalist conservatives here in the U.S. So it was sort of regarded as, Putin was sort of regarded as a model for what if we had a society where you had a strong man leader who was not afraid to use the power of government to support traditional values and traditional religion? And wouldn't that be so much better? And my argument in this article I posted is, and I think it's the thing that I see a lot of nationalist conservatives grappling with right now, is that the Russian invasion of Ukraine sort of shows the reality of what this means. That shows the reality of what does this use of the state in the service of traditional values and then of nationalist values, what does it mean in practice? And what it means is, you know, wholesale destruction, indiscriminate killing of civilians, a whole bunch of obviously sort of prima facie immoral things that are being done under the justification of we're fighting for the glory of our nation, we're fighting for the we're fighting for the imposition of religious values. And by the way, we can get into this in the discussion, but there is a definite religious dimension to the war in Ukraine. That there's this whole long-standing thing where the Russian Orthodox Church has been using the power of government to persecute non-Orthodox religions, Christian religions, and also as part of a power struggle within the Orthodox, the Eastern Orthodox Church, which I can get into later. But it's showing that the actual reality of this is not some superior moral society, but is actually, you know, depravity and mass killing, and is something deeply immoral. But the other thing that I find most interesting about this is it punctures the idea of Russia being a super powerful country. And what I mean by that is the fact that, you know, as I put it, the fact that we're still talking about this a little over 2 months, it's just like 2 months and 2 days since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The fact that we're still talking about this is proof that this supposedly stronger, more powerful Russian society, that's stronger, more powerful because they returned to traditional values and religion, and because they persecuted the gay people, they're so much stronger. That has really been punctured by the fact that they've been losing this war at every stage against a smaller country that, you know, ought to be less, a smaller country that didn't really have much of an army 8 years ago when this whole conflict began. It didn't have a big army by design. It was kept with a small army because the guy who was in charge in Ukraine, his whole goal was to be a sort of a puppet or satellite of Russia. So he avoided building up any kind of army. Their army's been built up almost entirely in the last 8 years and has proved to be at every point stronger and more powerful than the Russian army, which initially tried to take Ukraine and completely failed, and now is trying to take some areas in southern Ukraine and is not doing well. And the point is that this punctures the illusion of religious traditionalism and strongman rule being more powerful and stronger and the stronger creed than Western style liberalism and tolerance. And you know, it's an old sort of pretension that goes back, I mean, you know, goes back 100 years, goes back to, and I actually argued in a podcast recently, I argued that it goes back 2,500 years to the contest between the Athenians and the Spartans, right? That idea that has been sort of floating around in the culture since then is the idea that the Spartan-style culture, the one that's more authoritarian, the one that's more regimented, the one where all men are trained for nothing but war, and they don't care about art, and they don't care about philosophy, and they're not, you know, they're not devoted to the soft pursuits of the mind. They're going to be so much more powerful than the free, vibrant, diverse society like the Athenians. So if you go back to the examples I would direct you to, these are really easily, the great thing of this is all easily available on the web right now. So go look up the funeral, or Pericles' funeral oration. So this is the great Athenian leader, Pericles, the great Athenian statesman, the leader during most of the war with Sparta, who gave a funeral oration at the funeral of a large number of men who, Athenian men who died during the war. And he gives this sort of defense of Athenian values against Spartan values. And then contrast that to another one I'd have you look up, which is Plutarch's essay, The Life of Lycurgus. Lycurgus is the sort of legendary founder of the Spartan society, and the distinctive Spartan system, this regimented, authoritarian, war-centered society. And if you look there, Plutarch's a later Roman historian, but he's writing looking back on this. And there are people who argue that, oh, well, this isn't really an accurate representation of what Spartan organization was. And maybe it wasn't, but it shows that this dialogue has been going on for 2,500 years of this idea of this sort of the love of the Spartan system for being regimented and authoritarian and decisive and warlike and therefore being stronger, versus the defense of the more Athenian style, the more liberal, democratic, diverse, and less warlike society. And Pericles making the defense that they're actually are as strong as the Spartans and capable of defeating the Spartans. So this has been going on for hundreds of years, for thousands of years. And I, you know, you see it in this sort of attitude of the Japanese, especially, and the Germans, the beginning of World War II, the idea that these liberal societies in America are decadent and they're corrupt and they're weak, and all you have to do is attack them and they will collapse. And at the very beginning of World War II, it kind of looked like maybe that's the case, to some early successes that they had. And then, of course, by the end, they discovered that, you know, that basically Ohio was outproducing the industrial production of Ohio was greater than that of the entirety of Germany, and we basically buried them with the might of our civilization by the end of the war. And so it basically, you know, it was this demonstration of the superiority of the liberal and diverse values of a free society over the regimented, top-down, sort of more Spartan system. And I think in Ukraine, we're seeing another puncturing of that pretension. And it sort of raises the question of which way Western man, but raises it in a different way of showing that maybe the liberal model is actually the one that is not only morally superior and more inspiring, but is also actually stronger in the actual contest of civilizations being matched against one another. So that's the overall sort of topic I want to bring up, and then let's open the discussion.
Okay, good. We want to invite anyone that wants to come up to the stage. I'll try to kick things off a little bit. I think you know what you're saying is not a straw man. It definitely exists on the right, but I think it may be just a little bit of a broad brush. I looked up before the show, Yoram Hazony, the head of the National Conservatives, you know, was talking about how, you know, nationalists know Ukraine is fighting for the nation, which, I mean, isn't necessarily our message, but there can be a conservative nationalism that is not pro-Putin.
Yeah, and I think that's good to notice. I've seen sort of, there's been a variation in response on the nationalist side. So there, you know, one of the things I do point out is that there's some of them who seem to have forgotten that nationalism, if there is a country fighting for national sovereignty and national independence, it's clearly Ukraine. I'm glad to see Yoram Hazony acknowledging that. Some of the other nationalists have not acknowledged that. You know, the interesting thing about this is that, you know, Russia, I think they have a certain sympathy for Putin because he talks the talk. And he, you know, he was early in the first couple of weeks in the war, he starts talking about how he starts going on this riff. You know, they're in the middle of the country's in the middle of a war. He starts going on this riff about Harry Potter and canceling J.K. Rowling. And of course, she has, you know, J.K. Rowling wanted nothing to do with any of this because she, you know, she doesn't back Putin in any way. But this, this idea of sort of presenting himself as an opponent of cancel culture. So he is definitely trying to make an appeal to and recruit or appeal to the Western anti-cancel culture people on the right. And I think that has created this sort of sympathy for him. But Russia is actually an imperialist power. It's not a nationalist power. It's imperialist. It's about Russia having dominion over all these countries that are not Russia, that are, you know, not just Ukraine. Ukraine is so close to Russia that there's almost a bit of plausibility to the idea that, well, really they're part of Russia, even though it has a distinctive identity. But there's this long history of, oh, we also have to control Kazakhstan, and we have to control Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. We have to, you know, have to control Poland. So, you know, Russia has a long history as an imperialist power where there's a Russian ethnic state that dominates a bunch of other non-Russian states around it. And so, yeah, I do think that, you know, you could make the case that the consistent nationalist should be in favor of, should be backing Ukraine as they're the ones fighting for their nation and their national sovereignty. But I think that for a lot of the people who call themselves nationalist conservatives, it's not necessarily just about nationalism. Well, okay, so here's the argument on that I put on forth on this, which is nationalism, and maybe this is a good thing to bring up and discuss. Nationalism is an equivocal term because it can mean dedication to a particular nation. It can be this, you know, you can use this to mean the same thing as patriotism. You know, I love America, therefore I am in favor of the American nation and I am a nationalist. I think it's a very narrow and selective definition of it. Or nationalism can mean a belief in the nation state as a political organization and maybe dedication to one nation in particular. But nationalism could also mean the idea that the individual needs to be subordinated to the greater good of the nation as a whole. And this is more sort of fascist style nationalism, right? The idea of it's the collectivism. It's nationalism as collectivism. Nationalism as the idea that individual and his interests and desires and decisions must be subordinated to the greater good of the state. The greater good of the nation as determined by the state and oftentimes as determined by the leader of the state. And so nationalism in that sense comes to actually mean authoritarianism. It's sort of like a polite euphemism for what they really are in favor of is authoritarianism. And so I think that's sort of the dividing line that causes some people to become more sympathetic to Putin and to Putin's cause in Ukraine among the nationalist conservatives because they're attracted, what they're really attracted to is the authoritarianism of it. But it's good to acknowledge that there are some people who are taking the opposite approach.
Good. All right. Well, good. Well, let's go to Roger One. Roger Hunt, thank you for joining us.
Sure. This is awesome. Thanks, Rob. I actually agree with everything you said. I'm very excited this time. This is wonderful. I was actually wanted to give you some more space to talk about Athens and Sparta, because if anything was a broad brush, I think that might have been it. Certainly, Athens wasn't all unicorns and daisies and flowers, and Sparta wasn't all just punching each other in the stomach all day. But I get the metaphor, and you know I can appreciate that. But I'm wondering if you I don't know, or maybe that's the way you think it was. But if you want to double down on that view of those two, or maybe dive in a little deeper, or just say it was just a metaphor, and I don't want to talk about it anymore. That's fine.
Well, I'm gonna do a little of each. I'll add a little more detail. So I was at one point studying classics, so I immersed myself in some of this pretty deeply, but I am not the world's greatest expert. So I'll acknowledge there is a difference between the sort of mythology that's built up over Athens versus Sparta versus the reality. And that's always the case, right? There was the reality of how the systems works, and the Spartan system was not actually in practice quite as fully authoritarian. It had, you know, distinctively Greek elements to it. It was, you know, a society. It was an oligarchy, but a society in which citizens had a certain amount of, it was also a slave society, but it was one in which citizens had a certain degree of autonomy. And they, you know, had limits on the powers of the kings and things like that. So it wasn't as authoritarian as some of the mythology that built up around it might have you believe. And the Athenian system, of course, they also were a slave society. They held slaves. And they also limited the democracy to a small subset of citizens, and there were many people who were not allowed to vote, and they were not a fully free society in the way we would recognize it. And of course, they famously did things like putting Socrates to death, and of course today, of course, when you say Spartans, I like you saying punching themselves in the stomach all the time. When you say the Spartans, everybody thinks, oh yeah, that movie 300, I saw that, which is literally it is a comic book version of Sparta. It was based on a comic book by the same guy the same guy who did the Dark Knight Batman comics, and who clearly has this big thing for this Spartan sense of life. But that comic book version we get in the movie comes from what was done, this mythologization of it happened in the ancient world. And it happened in this sense of trying to create these two different models for how you'd organize a society, of a more authoritarian and martial, militaristic, and stoic and self-sacrifice based model for a society, that your goal is to serve the state by, enduring hardship and engaging in constant military training and punching each other in the stomach all day, and engaging and focusing on nothing but war. That's what will make the state great. It will make you strong. Versus that Athenian approach, which is that, we're going to have a much more diverse, a much more free society. People are allowed to do whatever they want. And yet when the crisis comes and an emergency happens, we will prove to be as strong, or if not stronger, than the other guys. And I really recommend, one of the great joys of reading Thucydides, for those of us who are inclined to do so, one of the great joys of reading the ancient Greek historian Thucydides is coming across the funeral oration by Pericles, which is this sort of example of a historian giving a great speech delivered by a great man, defending the values of his society. And it defends the idea of this more what we would call liberal and diverse and non-Spartan Athenian society, and defending how that is that actually makes them strong, and how they're able to basically defending the superiority of his society. So that all said, I'm going to then end with your last option, which is this is all kind of a metaphor. The ancient Greek Athens versus Sparta stuff, as it survives today, is all sort of a metaphor for what in more recent times is this idea that, fascism or communism, in various incarnations, it's been claimed that they are more powerful because they teach the individual to sacrifice his own interests and to be, stoical and to endure hardship and endure suffering. And that's what's going to make them strong and powerful. versus the liberal societies, the Western, the democratic societies, where we allow our people, you know, where it's people are allowed and even encouraged to go off and pursue their own interests and pursue their own pleasures and express themselves. And yet at the same time, you know, it's been proved numerous times in the past that when we go off to war and when the emergency calls and we have to rise to the occasion, we are actually capable of being not just strong and powerful, but stronger, more stronger and more powerful than our adversaries. And I think that's the thing to look at in the current context.
I'm glad you mentioned Thucydides. Whenever somebody mentions Nietzsche to me, I always ask if they read him, and if they haven't, I just turn away.
Good stuff. I want to encourage everyone to share the room. Also, raise your hand if you want to join the conversation. I have a question for Rob on the topic. Roger, thank you for joining us. Roger, too. I believe you're there, but actually, why don't we go to Daniel and then we'll come back to Roger.
Hi, guys. I'm enjoying a lot the room. Thank you very much. Regarding what drives Western society, on the one hand, we can argue individualism, but like following Hegel, this idea that we are always in the pursuit of more agency, more freedom, seems to also explain and match what we are going through. That will be the inside the question. And anything that you can say on the relation of libertarianism and Hegel?
And Hegel?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I am not a great expert on Hegel, but I know enough to know I do not regard Hegel as being a great friend of libertarianism, because I think what he means, or a great friend of you know, pro-freedom ideas, because I think what he means by freedom is not what we mean. Hegel is most famous actually for being one of the guys who laid the philosophical foundations for collectivism and for the idea that the individual is really just a fragment of some larger group, some larger, more powerful force. Hegel was the guy who came up with the idea of, I think he described it as the spirit of the age. And actually behind that is the idea of the spirit per se, spirit with a capital S, which is this idea that there's sort of this sort of great collective consciousness that we're all part of. And this great collective consciousness is involved in a quest to know itself. So when he talks about spirit, he's not talking about the individual human spirit. He's talking about this sort of collective world spirit, and that this world spirit is going on a great quest to know itself and to gain full freedom, but it's full freedom for the collective world spirit, right? So it's freedom for the collective rather than freedom for the individual. And so he tends to have this idea that the individual is actually shaped by the one of the phrases he uses, the spirit of the age, that every era and every nationality has its own sort of national spirit, and it's a spirit that's representative of that particular age, which is this sort of collective consciousness that's working through its current stage of development, of which the individual is just a reflection. And that's how he comes up with, so how he's used and how he ends up being used in historically, I know, in terms of the political consequences, is along with, he sort of developed an idea that began with Jean-Jacques Rousseau, which is the idea of a great leader as representing the collective will or the general will of the people. And that was definitely how Hegel was used. I'm not a super expert on Hegel, so I'm not sure how much of this is actually in Hegel himself versus how much was drawn out by the subsequent Hegelians. But I know that there was a foundation laid there, especially in Germany, for the idea of that a great leader would come along who would embody this great collective spirit and give it voice and give it and express its will, and everybody would find quote unquote freedom by their submission to the greater will of this great leader who represents the collective. And you can see how in Germany, within 100 years or so of Hegel, that would lead to a lot of trouble. That you would have a guy who would say, "Yes, here I am. I'm the voice, the embodiment of the collective will." So the problem I see with Hegel is that aspect of metaphysical collectivism that he introduced, and which was, of course, then adopted by one of his students, one of his followers was Karl Marx, who had adopted the same general idea of the collectivist approach to viewing the individual as just the cell within a greater whole, which he then developed in a different direction, but to very much the same end, which is eventually we're going to have, you know, a great leader who come along who will represent the will of the collective. So that's the problem I would have with, you know, everybody's, I think really a sort of a post-enlightenment thing is that everybody said to say the cause of freedom, the cause of liberty had so much moral authority to it that everybody who came along had to say, yes, I'm for freedom. And then what they did is they kind of redefined what freedom meant in various ways to allow them to do something that's not pro-freedom. And one of the ways that happened was that idea of defining freedom as the freedom of the collective will rather than the individual will. Yeah, but that may be more into the weeds than we want to go.
Yeah, pretty interesting take. The way I see it is that applies, but mostly to the people who came after Hegel, Marx and others, and also to note that there is like a left and right.
The left Hegelians and the right Hegelians. I know those guys, yeah.
Yeah, goes both ways. But just by going the first principle that he seems to manage, that was freedom, I don't know how we can understand freedom other than in the individual. I mean, of course, we can try, but for what I have read about him, he's talking about more agency, more of the freedom that has to be, as he presents it, at the individual level. I'm getting where we're. Interpretation.
And one of the problems talking about Hegel, and the reason why I demur a bit, I'm not the world's greatest expert on Hegel, is I kind of gave up reading him a little bit because he's famously obscure. His work is really heavy and in this very obscure academic style, and it is sometimes a little hard to figure out exactly what the heck he's saying. And so I recognize that people draw different things out of it. I mean, okay, so one of the most surreal experiences I've had in the last couple of years is I ended up having a Twitter exchange about Hegel with MC Hammer. Now, some of you younger people may not realize how deeply weird this is, but MC Hammer was like a sort of a hip-hop performer in the 1980s, you know, can't touch this, that kind of thing, Hammer Time. If you're old enough, you'll recognize it. If you're not, you'll be scrunching your brow at me and wonder what the heck I'm talking about. But the idea that somehow I would end up, you know, 30 years later having a Twitter exchange with him about Hegel is sort of not, it was not what I was expecting. Let's put it that way. But apparently he's been studying Hegel, and he did it because Martin Luther King read Hegel and was influenced by him in this way. So that's why my roundabout and slightly bizarre way of saying that I recognize that people are capable of drawing different and sometimes better things out of Hegel, but that he did also establish set the seeds for this collectivist approach. And like you said, I didn't want to get into this, but there's the left Hegelians and the right Hegelians, the generation that came after him. And the left Hegelians basically produce Marxism, and the right Hegelians produce fascism. And and you get these two collectivist ideologies that come out of that.
Daniel, I do want to give Roger just a chance to pop in here. Roger, are you back yet?
Yeah, absolutely. Enjoying the conversation.
Good.
Rob, glad you're doing this room. It's timely. I get these arguments with people about when there's an opposition to globalism, which I stand in opposition to. I'm quite certain you do as well. And there seems to be this knee-jerk reaction that, like, well, if you're opposed to globalism, well, then the way to do that is to be a strong nationalist. And so basically, it's okay to be an authoritarian, you know, for some folks, as long as they localize their authority. And my question for you is, do you see a way out of these fixed mindsets? That I didn't get a chance to read your entire article. I was reading some of it. But it feels to me like the philosophers of the past drew upon like real world experience and came up with, you know, they developed philosophies through trial and error. Something would go wrong, they would say, okay, well, there's the flaw in that, and then new philosophies would emerge. And now we've kind of gotten stuck in these really weak-minded, like, you know, like American conservatism, you know, neoliberalism, no thank you. And I'm just wondering, like, do you see a way out of this? You know, when I read, you know, Which Way Western Man, I'm guessing that you might be an advocate of, hey, go read Rand, and objectivism might lead the way. But how do we even get people to understand that the philosophies that we're adhering to, or maybe even the lack of paying attention to any philosophy, has kind of gotten us into a lot of trouble, and we need to find a way, because the roads that we're on are dangerous.
Right. Okay, so two things I want to talk about that. One is that I am a globalist, at least in one sense, which is that I believe in free trade. I believe in having a global capitalism and a global economy, and the demonization of free trade as being responsible for, and of the global economy as being responsible for all of our ills, is, I think, sort of a ridiculous sort of over exaggeration. It's become a grab bag that you blame on everything. But the other aspect of the globalism too is, I think globalism is just fine, as long as it's globalism on liberal terms. And by liberal, I mean not in the domestic. We have a weird domestic sense of liberalism where it means, you know, big government statism, whereas the actual, you know, across the world and throughout history, liberalism has always meant, and for the political philosopher, liberalism still means the idea of a free society, a society based on individual rights, the rule of law, limited government, guarantees for individual freedoms, that sort of thing. So I would like to see global liberalism, right? So, but globalism and liberalism, not in the sense that are used by
globalist liberals,
that are used by the conservatives as terms of disapproval. But also not in the sense necessarily used by the people in America who call themselves liberals, or the people who sometimes call themselves globalists here. So, but moving on from that, the other issue was, how do we, I really like your idea of this about philosophy being an attempt to deal with the real world, with a response to the real things that have happened. Now, I would say that historically, there's always been two different approaches to philosophy. One is an attempt to try to, that I sort of refer to it, I would think of it in the fundamental sense as a conservative approach, which I think is the wrong approach, which is, there's an existing set of presumptions, assumptions and social arrangements that you are clinging to, that you want to preserve. And so you rationalize, and so anything new that's happened that disrupts that old approach, you try to explain it away. And I view Plato, for example, as being an example of that, where you have a sort of a nascent beginnings of a scientific worldview happening in ancient Athens. And he comes up with what is essentially a philosophical rationalization for mysticism. The idea that, no, don't look at reality, don't look at facts, don't engage in scientific exploration, look inward and try to intuit the realm of pure forms. It's this return to sort of a religious, mystical style of thinking, epistemology, rather than the more, you know, of course, his student Aristotle would come along and say, no, let's go all in on this scientific worldview, and let's, you know, go gather all these facts and induce new ideas and new concepts from these facts. So I think you have in Plato and Aristotle, the real fundamental there is you have an approach to philosophy that is, let's try to justify all the old traditional existing systems versus one that says, let's react to the new things that are being done. I mentioned Thucydides earlier, right? So Thucydides comes along about 50 years or so before Aristotle and basically develops, he has a few precursors, but he basically develops the modern science of history, the idea of an evidence-based approach to history where you go investigate and you get eyewitness testimony and physical evidence and you compare all the different accounts and try to figure out what happened. Basically, all the rules that that for modern scientific approach to history, Thucydides develops. Well, and then 50 years on later on, Aristotle comes along seeing all that happening in science, in history, in literature, all these new ideas coming along, and comes along and develops new philosophical ideas in reaction to that or to trying to capture these new things that are being done intellectually. And I think that's the exact right approach to philosophy. And I think too much of what we have right now is there's a bunch of categories people have in their head about here are the alternatives you have. You're either an American liberal, meaning you're big government, pro-welfare state, or you're an American conservative, which is you're religious and traditionalist. And those are just the alternatives. And we can't think about anything new or different that might be possible. And I think that's the mindset we have to break people out of, is this idea of let's look at reality, you know, and see what's actually happening and that there are other alternatives.
All right. Good stuff. C, sorry. Welcome. Chris?
Yeah. Sorry.
It's all right.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to cut across, Scott. The point that Roger made about globalism or globalists. I remember Yaron Brook saying last year that that's a myth. It shouldn't be globalism. It's globalization. It's like Rob said. It's kind of like a dirty word, globalism. I don't about free trade across the world kind of thing. The proper term should be globalization, not globalism. So therefore, you can eliminate the term globalist as well.
My response to that is I think globalism or globalist or even globalization to a certain extent is sort of a definition by non-essentials, right? So because it's about the idea of something being global as opposed to, well, what is it that's being global, right? So if it's global capitalism, great. If it's global communism, bad, right? So it's like an attempt to denounce something because it's worldwide or global or it's spreading outside, it's somehow evolving something that's outside of national boundaries without first asking, well, what is that thing that's outside of national boundaries? So I think it'd be fabulous. It'd be terrific. And I think it's actually happening to some extent. If our values, American values, values of individualism and individual rights and individual freedom and the use of reason, if those became more global values. And I think that's actually already happening. I actually made an argument a while back. I wrote an article called The Case Against Western Civilization. And of course, I did this knowing that my readers, at least the people who know me, would know that I'm not saying Western, you know, that the things we associate with Western civilization are bad. So I'm not against reason. I'm not against individual rights. I'm not against, et cetera, all these distinctively Western values. But rather, I think I've come out against the idea of describing them as Western. I actually prefer to describe them as Enlightenment values, because I think they're the values that came out of the intellectual ferment of the 18th century Enlightenment, and which I think have been developed to a higher stage and a higher, more exact and a stronger foundation developed to a higher level of intellectual definition by Ayn Rand. But those Enlightenment values are, I think, what defines what's the best parts of our civilization. And I also see plenty of evidence that those have spread beyond the traditional quote unquote West. That, you know, they've made inroads in Asia, and especially among the sort of Asian tiger countries, the relatively free societies, and even some of those that are under attack right now, like in Hong Kong, where the Chinese are cracking down. You know, some of the most bravest and most courageous things done in favor of quote unquote Western values have been done by Chinese people in Hong Kong in the last few years. So it's clear that these are no longer distinctively Western in that strictly geographic sense. So that's what I would like to see is, and you could call it globalization of Enlightenment values, but I think it's already happening. I'd like to see it happen more, is the idea that these values that had their origin in the West are of such universal value and of such universal appeal that they eventually take hold everywhere. Someday they'll take hold in Russia.
Good. Thank you for that. Jimmy, do you have a question for Rob? Thank you for joining us.
I'm pretty much just listening in. I'm at an airport waiting to fly to Vegas, so I'm just going to listen in.
Nice. Hey, you're going the right way.
They say pursuit of happiness, flying to Vegas.
It's the flight back.
No, I'm on my way to California, so yeah, not very good.
I see. Well, we have a treat. We have Richard Salzman, TAS senior scholar. So, Richard, do you have a question for Rob?
I do, Rob. Great conversation. Great topic. What do you think about going on the globalization versus globalism? There's a kind of Jeffersonian notion that the closer government is to the individual, the more it's going to be respectful of individual rights. So if you expand that out to, you know, county, federal, global, I do agree with Chris who said, you know, globalization really is universal free trade. We shouldn't be against that. But this notion of one world government or the UN or these alliances like NATO, it does worry people that they're forms of governance that are too removed from the individual. But I heard you also to say, well, if you knew that world government was free government, was capitalist, why wouldn't you go for that? If we could be assured of that. So what do you think of this whole idea of whether, you know, locate, say, the nation state as the locus of power, really what it is today? Is it worth going more global with government or shrink it down to, as Grover Norquist used to say, shrink it down to the bathtub till you can strangle it? But you know what I'm getting at, Rob? Levels of governance is my question.
Yeah, I think Grover Norquist quote, I think, is government should be small enough that you can drown it in the bathtub. That's sort of a famous or infamous phrase, depending on
Rob, I'm a Hamiltonian who thinks, as long as it behaves, more constitutional, wider scope government is okay if you can do that. But well, I don't think most people don't think it can be done.
Right. So I'm not a Hamiltonian so much as I'm a Madisonian, and I like his position in. I'm like a broken record about Federalist Number 10, which is my favorite of the Federalist Papers, where he talks about this idea of the problem of faction. He says, how do you keep, you know, a faction from gaining power and using the power of government, harnessing the power of government to basically promote its own goals or interests or, you know, its narrow interests at the expense of everybody else? How do you keep a faction from hijacking government? And the idea prior to him had been that, well, the best way to do it is to say, keep the government smaller, closer to the local level. And this was the argument in favor of having a very, very weak federal government and having most of the power really be in the state governments. And this idea goes all the way back to ancient Greece, of the idea that a small republic would be better than a large republic. And he made the argument that no, actually it's the opposite, that if you expand the sphere of activity, that the more the larger and more diverse the society, the less power any one particular faction would have, because it would be harder to find a majority of other people who agree, you know, who have the same interests and who agree with you. So think in terms of, you know, tariffs, right? Yeah, if tariffs benefit a particular industry that's very strong in a few states, the larger you have the country, the harder it is to get a majority of people to impose tariffs to support that one industry, because most people will not have that same interest. Or you could apply it to slavery. You know, one of the reasons why the Civil War happened is because the government, America was expanding westward. We were bringing in more and more states that didn't have slavery, that didn't have that vested interest in maintaining the system. And the Southern states basically panicked because they realized they were about to be outvoted. And that's why they fired on Fort Sumter. So there's that argument. Now, I would say, my ideal is probably something more like the nation state as the fundamental unit of government, including in some cases large, diverse nation states like America, with, though, a series of alliances or larger unions between them that don't have a lot of power, but which are mainly exist to reduce the barriers and to reduce the animosities and to reduce, to have an orderly international system and reduce military conflict, etc. And eventually you would settle into not a one world government, but rather a national governments with a series of international treaties or organizations or institutions that basically, increasingly prevent them from being in, resolve the conflicts between them and prevent those conflicts from getting out of hand. So that's sort of the ideal. But on the other hand, I think that, we're so far from that we don't know what it's going to look like when it eventually arrives, right? but I do see that there's a value to something like everything you're talking about here is encapsulated in the European Union. Because the European Union began with the kind of union I was talking about, which is the common market, this idea of like we're all getting together and we're going to reduce the barriers to trade and we're going to make it easier to trade goods across international borders amongst these free countries. And then it became also, though, this bloated, bureaucratic, a bunch of guys in Brussels deciding what to do and imposing it on everybody else. And this 500-page European constitution, this thing, something so ridiculously bloated and complicated that it becomes a preserve for all this unaccountable power, which is why I supported Brexit. I supported Britain removing itself from the European Union. So on the one hand, I think it's good to be pursuing these larger international treaties or unions or free trade zones, et cetera, where you're reducing the military and economic conflict between countries and making it easier for those countries to work together. But at the same time, we're doing this in a context where the pro-individualist, pro-free market liberal values are not accepted by a lot of people, where there's, every time you create an international union, somebody sees it as, oh, great, this is a chance for us to wield all this power out of Brussels as these faceless bureaucrats pulling the strings. So, I think what we have to have is we have to have international organizations and international cooperation, but on the basis of everyone having the shared value of we all want to have free societies, and how that's implemented in terms of you have a parliamentary system or what kind of voting, that's different to different societies. But we have to have that shared values that would then allow us to have wider international unions that would not be oppressive or over-centralized.
Yeah, good thoughts. And one thing I have always thought, Rob, and I wonder what you think of this, I've come to believe I'm not really against the United Nations, but can you imagine if it was crafted as such, the United Civilized Nations, and this is a club that's not easy to get into. And if you're not in our club, we are not going to allow any international shenanigans or invasions or anything like that. But But, you know, if you said that today, they would say, what do you mean? United Nations has to include every nation, including the barbaric ones. And so that gets back to your point about Western. It would be nice to have a United Nations, an alliance of civilized capitalist nations. You agree with that? Yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, the idea of a union of free countries or something like that, that's been floated a bunch of times.
Yeah.
I think Biden tried to do something with that a year or so ago, you know, and the idea has been around and people have been puttering around at it. Now, the thing is that the United Nations came up in a specific context of post-World War II and the Cold War context where you had there was no way for it to be a reunion of free nations. What it had, it ended up being a way for the main rivals in the Cold War to be able to sort of talk to each other.
Yeah.
And it was an attempt to try to have some form of cooperation where we wouldn't all blow each other up.
but you could reasonably ask why are we united between USA and USSR? There's no uniting. We're mortal enemies. You can't be in the same club. But anyway, great stuff, Rob. Thank you.
Thank you. I do want to give Daniel a chance to get a question in here. Thank you for your patience, Daniel.
Hey, thank you. No, I'm enjoying a lot the conversation. I'm going to go to meta, but if it's possible, hope you can consider the question. There is a problem that I see with all ideologies, from either left or right. They always fall short when meeting with reality, and that becomes their main fault. They are not able to actualize themselves quickly enough or even consider things that happen that are beyond what the ideology is trying to explain and do. Is there something that can help libertarianism to fall into that somehow?
So I'm going to make a case for ideology, though. I think if ideas are based on observation of reality, they can actually capture the real world. They can be appropriate to the real world. And I think one of the great examples I would point to that is America's founding fathers, right, who not only adopted these sort of Lockean ideas of individual rights because they read them in a book by John Locke, but who also then went out and said, okay, we have to totally remake the government of, you know, the United States. We have to, they first went out and rewrote all the state constitutions in order to reflect this new idea, more perfectly and more accurately reflect this ideology of individual rights. But then they said, and furthermore, our national government isn't working very well. We have to scrap that whole thing and sit down and write a new national constitution. And then they hashed it out in all sorts of different ways, and they're bitter, oftentimes very bitter political conflicts between the Hamiltonians and the Jeffersonians. Now, by the way, I know Richard's a Hamiltonian. I'm a Jeffersonian. I'm working on my musical to try to. I'm a big fan of Jefferson's Secretary of the Treasury, Albert Gallatin. So I'm working on Gallatin, the musical that'll be coming out soon. So look for that.
Something.
But you know, I think that the idea of that you had a group of people who were both extremely plugged into and following and influenced by the ideas of the Enlightenment philosophers, but at the same time, we're also practical statesmen creating a government and creating political parties and engaging in debates over how that government was, you know, not just how the Constitution was going to be written, but then in the Jefferson versus Madison thing, or Jefferson versus Hamilton thing, how we're actually going to implement that and how we're going to interpret that. So I think there's a great example there of people who can bridge both sides, that they're in contact with reality enough that they have not only they have the Enlightenment ideals, but they also have the approach of let's figure out how these are actually implemented in the context of this nation we have and the existing political organizations and the balance of forces and how we create something that can last for almost 250 years now that will embody those values.
Great. Great way to wrap it up. Good topic, Rob. Tomorrow, the Atlas Society asks Robert Bryce at 5 p.m. Eastern on the myth of green energy. Thursday, back here on Clubhouse at 4 p.m. Eastern, TAS founder David Kelly will be talking about cognitive bias. Thursday at 8 p.m., Richard Salzman will be doing morals and markets. And then Friday at 5:30 p.m. Eastern, Professor Jason Hill will be doing part two on Clubhouse of why defeating Russia and defending Ukraine is in our national interest. So we hope you join us for those. In the meantime, Rob and everyone, thanks for doing this, who participated, and we'll see you soon. Take care.
Thanks, everyone.